Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. Norway is commemorating last year's bomb and gun massacre that left 77 people dead. On July 22nd last year, 33-year-old Anders Behring Breivik admitted to the attacks but declined criminal guilt, saying the victims were traitors for embracing immigration and making Norway a multicultural society. His fate will be determined on August 24th. Joining us to talk about coverage of the shooting and the anniversary is freelance journalist Øyvind Straumen. He joins us from Oslo. He won the Freelance Journalist Award last year for investigating fascist and extremist groups in Norway. Hi, Øyvind. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. And the massacre in Aurora, Colorado has received wall-to-wall coverage. Last Friday, the day after the shootings happened, we talked about the formulaic coverage and simplistic framing of the issue. So how has it been covered since then? What have you learned? Are reporters asking and exploring the right questions? And what are the right questions? Joining us to talk about coverage of that is James Grimaldi. In 2010, James was part of the team that worked on an investigative series called The Hidden Life of Guns for the Washington Post. Pieces include how politics protect gun dealers, NRA-led gun lobbies' powerful influence, and over 62,000 guns unaccounted for in the U.S. since 2008. James is now an investigative reporter with The Wall Street Journal. In 2006, he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the Jack Abramoff scandal. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you. And Anaheim, California is still in a state of unrest following two police shootings last weekend. We'll get into details later in the show, but just briefly, on Saturday, Manuel Diaz was shot twice from behind while fleeing from police unarmed. After about 100 locals assembled to speak out against police violence, officers fired rubber bullets and pepper sprayed adults and children in the crowd. Video shows a police dog chasing people. And then the very next day, police shot and killed Jose Acevedo. Police say he was a suspect in a car robbery, but the circumstances around his death remain unconfirmed. This is the eighth officer-involved shooting in Anaheim within 1 year. The LA Times reports that the unrest has exposed long simmering divisions in Anaheim between the glitz of Disney and professional sports and the struggles of the less prosperous Latino neighborhoods in Orange County's largest city. Roberto Lovato has been following this closely. He wrote a piece for Fox News Latino. I didn't even know Fox News had a Latino section, but we'll talk about that, called Anaheim Protesters Are Not to Blame. Police are. Roberto Lovato is a writer and commentator with New America Media, The Nation, and other outlets. And Roberto joins us in studio. He argues that Latino voices are missing from most of the coverage. Hi, Roberto. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Roberto, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, before anything, being that we're in the Bay Area, I would be remiss not to mention the passing of an extraordinary and consequential journalist, Alexander Coburn, who's being lauded from left to right, from the Wall Street Journal to The Nation, where he and I wrote. So I encourage people to look at those obituaries because you'll find some inspiration and of that great voice. My story is
just quickly on this, because I'm glad you brought this up. What do you think about the type of journalism that he did, and where are these voices today?
If you look at Huffington Post and Fox News, he previewed them in terms of being a journalist with a voice, not just with this kind of objective approach. It's also important in terms of investigative reporting and other kinds of reporting, but Alexander had an extraordinary journalistic and literary voice, and he combined the two with radical politics in a way that, whether you agreed with him or not, you had to listen because of the eloquence and the precision and the delicacy with which he wrote.
He like you said, there were articles about his work all over.
Throughout the spectrum.
Yeah.
So my favorite...
Sure.
My favorite articles in the Guardian, today's Guardian, about demonstrations in Mexico blockading Televisa, the largest television network there.
Oh.
The Guardian had done previous reporting on what what appears to be corruption on the part of Televisa of the Mexican political process by taking money to favor the coverage of the current person who's allegedly elected, Peña Nieto. So there's this, you know, Mexican spring going on, as embodied by a group called Yo Soy Uno 32, I Am 132. And they've thousands of people are surrounding Televisa Network in order to call them out. This is not a new story in Mexico or in Latin America, because in Oaxaca and other places, people have been making the media the object of and exposing them for what they consider their role as actors in the political process in an unfair and kind of cynical way, they see, in terms of how, for example, they promote certain candidates or how they don't talk about people being killed in Mexico as victims, because many of them, if not most of the people being killed in Mexico right now are not drug dealers,
right,
and people involved in that. They're innocent people. I've met them. I just got back recently.
And
Televisa is owned by Carlos Slim, who also is a big investor in the New York Times.
Okay.
The richest man in the world. And I suspect that this tactic of identifying the media as and framing them as an issue, as a problem, is going to cross over and migrate into the U.S. You have, for example, here in the Bay Area today, I believe, in other U.S. cities, people affiliated with Yo Soy Uno 32 going to, I think, Univision. I saw some press release that was sent to me. They're going to be going to Univision today in different cities to contest their alliance with Televisa.
Huh, we'll have to follow that. Thank you. We'll put links to that on our website right after the show. That is Roberto Lovato. And what about you, James? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I if I could do two quick ones. One would be work that I would want to see honored by Jeremy Page of the Wall Street Journal. He's the reporter who broke the story about what was behind the police chief who in China who turned himself over to a consulate. It ended up leading to a story about the murder of a British citizen and an investigation into Bo Chi Lai and his wife, Gu Kai Lai, who was indicted yesterday by a Chinese court. Obviously a very secretive country. He was able to unearth what was going on there and expose probably one of the biggest crises in China in a generation. And second, I would probably honor a former colleague of mine at the Washington Post, Brady Dennis, for a very nice profile he did of a bicyclist who had the misfortune of stopping off in Aurora, Colorado, and attending the Batman premiere where he was shot. He was on a cross-country journey, and the odds of that having happened. And it's really a beautifully written story if you haven't seen it.
I can't wait to read that one. Thank you for those. And just quickly, Jeremy Page, your colleague, how was he able to get this information in China?
Well, through a lot of sources that can't really be revealed. It's reporting in China is a very, very difficult thing. You know, there are some reporters who can't even get in because of stories they've written in the past. There are some reporters who lose their visas. So it's a very delicate balance in terms of how you develop sources on a story like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it includes expats, diplomatic sources, and dissident sources, all sorts of there are a variety of things, like any good reporter does.
Right.
You kind of absorb yourself in the community.
Well, so kudos to Jeremy Page at the Wall Street Journal and then the Washington Post's Brady Dennis for what sounds like a really sad tribute, but that just brings out the fact that there are so many angles to this massacre, which we'll be talking about on today's show. Thank you for that, James. And what about you, Øyvind? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, it's a good question. Of course, I've been working a lot with my book this week, so I've been quite busy. But in the news, what I've really been following is, of course, everything that's been going on surrounding the topic of the 22nd of July here in Norway. And I think one of the best stories that I've read this week in that concern is a story that was in the newspaper yesterday of one of the leading newspapers in Norway called VG. And they covered the letters that been receiving from prison, and actually the contacts that he has been having with right-wing extremists in other countries from prison. They have been able to get a hold of some of the letters and to really give people an overview of what is being written and what kind of material it is, and also sort of point out the kind of connections that he has. And this is going to lead to a big debate in Norway on whether he should be allowed to actually communicate in such a way while being in prison for his terrorist attacks. I think that's an important story, and it's been certainly a big story in Norway.
Well, and a big story also around the world. Time magazine quoted a public broadcaster in Oslo saying that, quote, there have been so many facets of the story which have been covered. People are tired of hearing about him, and it is very understandable that many people want closure, end quote. So where is Norway a year later, and what does the coverage look like this week?
Well, I mean, this week it's been mostly about the memorial events taking place. There's been concerts, there's been marches, etc., taking place. And, of course, that has taken a lot of the attention. And I think that it's probably correct to say that many Norwegians are a bit fed up, because it's, of course, we have been through the court case, and it was wall-to-wall coverage every day for weeks on end. And in that sense, it has been tough, and many Norwegians feel that they are a bit overwhelmed, I think, by all the media coverage that has been. Now, I think for the most part, the coverage the last week has been a bit different, because it's been focused not on Breivik, not on right-wing extremism or anything like that, but on the victims and on how people are getting on with their lives. And there's been really great stories with interviews with parents of young people that were killed, etc., in the newspapers. And I think that's important still. So the question of where are we today, I think it's a really difficult question to answer. Many people ask me from abroad if Norway has changed or if Norway is going to change. And I think it's really too early to say if we're going to have a change or not. I think that it has been a very large terror attack. It was a large number of people that were killed, and one in every four Norwegians actually knows someone who was affected in one way or the other by the terrorist attacks. Mm. And that's going to leave an impression. But what kind of an impression it's going to be, I think that's really too early to say.
Mm. We're speaking with Øyvind Stråmann from Oslo. He won the Freelance Journalist Award last year for investigating fascist and extremist groups in Norway. And he'll be with us for about five or so more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments for him about what this coverage looks like in Norway, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. On the eve of the trial, the report by the anti-racist group Hope Not Hate said that since the tragic event, the anti-Muslim movements, we're talking about foundations, bloggers, political activists, and street gangs, has continued to proliferate. The report said that far-right organizations are becoming more cohesive as they forge alliances throughout Europe and the U.S., with about 190 groups now identified as promoting an Islamophobic agenda. How much attention is this getting in the media in Norway?
Well, it has been getting quite a bit of attention, and it has been varying a lot, of course, throughout the months that have passed. I personally think that some of these things should have been looked more thoroughly into. On the other hand, one also has to look at the situation in Norway with a bit of different eyes, because as a result of the 22nd of July, my opinion is that it has really been problematic for the extreme right to recruit in Norway, and it's become more difficult, and the groups are also very splintered and very weak. And I think that might as well be a important lesson in regards to the 22nd of July, because right-wing extremism has never been strong in Norway, and yet it was in Norway that we saw this horrible terrorist attack. And I think that it should really be regarded as an example of international terrorism rather than as an example of domestic terrorism. And I think that the international perspective on it has been still somewhat lacking in Norwegian media. Obviously, Norwegian media has been looking into what kind of connections Breivik did have on the internet, the fact that he did go to England to take part in events of the English Defence League, etc., etc. But at the same time, there is a lot of things going on in the international sphere when it comes to these kinds of groupings. I'm not sure if I entirely agree with the report of Hope Not Hate, but I think that it's important to look at these groups because there is certainly in their ideology a potential for more violence. And we've also seen other examples of violence in Norway and in the European countries.
You know, Øyvind, it's interesting that you use the word terrorist, because when we talked about media coverage of the shootings in Aurora, Colorado last week, we got a few emails from listeners who said that they find it interesting that when a shooting is done by a white male American, it's not called terrorism in the media. If it were done by, you know, say a Muslim at a military base in Texas, it would be called terrorism. Roberto, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, there's. If you look at the media reporting on Colorado, or actually most any incidents of this level of extreme violence, you're going to find two things. One is a different standard by which that's applied to whites who perpetrate. And by the way, whites are the ones who perpetrate the vast majority of these killings. If you look at the tragic lists of these murders that have been accumulating over the years. So there's a different standard for when it's a white person that perpetrates them, a different frame, a different focus. And then let some of us ask ourselves, for example, in the Latino community, what if all those people in the movie house, if that took place in Pico Union in L.A. or in Washington Heights in New York or in Brownsville, Texas, would we get the same kind of coverage of looking in the eyes of those victims, hearing their family stories? If we look at the coverage of 9/11, where a lot of undocumented people died, the answer is going to be absolutely not. They're not human. So there's a different standard of humanity in the reporting on the media. You see this throughout in the media's. I mean, something I've been spent time in El Salvador during the war, and it's disconcerting to see the way, for example, that violence requires demonization and dehumanization. You can't kill somebody if you believe they're human. You can't. So we have to look at the media that way and the media's role in the dehumanization of people. And if we look at that, I mean, that we have a big problem because of the addiction to violent imagery, violent language, and then the violent actions that follow.
James Grimaldi, what is your take on this? And not only the word terrorism, but the issues that Roberto just brought up.
Well, I think he's... I feel like it sounds like he's conflating two different things. You have what you might call your traditional mainstream media, and when you're talking about violent images, that sounds like we're talking about movies and television and the entertainment industry. And I guess I'm very leery of a complete broad sweep condemnations of one or the other, and I prefer to sort of look at isolated examples for what you might be talking about. I can't think of, at least in the Washington Post and now at the Wall Street Journal, that really falls into the category that he's speaking of. It feels to me as if he may be talking about maybe the commentary press and in terms of how that's addressed or who's quoted and so forth. So I'm not, I don't necessarily subscribe to that sense. And, you know, I know we have standards at the Wall Street Journal. I think we try to play incidents either kind pretty straightforward and not convey any particular opinion one way or another.
Yeah, we definitely don't agree on this because I've seen, just in the reporting on Anaheim, for example, there was a report by the AP reporter there, Raquel Maria Dillon, with the title Latinos Protesting in Violence. There were no Latinos reported in the story. The AP, which is the standard that's distributed throughout every media throughout the world, wrote a story about Latinos that, forgot to mention Latinos.
She didn't quote any Latinos.
She didn't quote any Latinos, but then proceeded to paint them as the violent perpetrators of all this stuff when the people that shot the brains out of the young man, Manuel Diaz, were the police. And the story quoted primarily the police and the mayor. And so we have, if we don't see the fundamental problems, the fundamental racial divide that W.E. Du Bois talked about in the mainstream as well. It's not, I have friends at the Washington Post. I have friends at the Wall Street Journal. But I also know there's people who disguise their right-wing dehumanization of fellow human beings under the guise of media objectivity. And to deny that at this stage in the game is disturbing.
Well, I'll just say you can't count me in that category.
Well, and also, Roberto, we'll talk about this later in the show, but you did have a tweet campaign to contact the AP reporter to ask her to interview Latinos.
Yes.
And then they did come out with a story. Because we noticed that most newspapers did not have national reporters there. They carry the AP piece that you just cited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in the second half of the show. Oyvind, what are your thoughts on, I mean, have you been watching at all or following the debate in the U.S. about guns and violence? Did you follow the coverage over the last week about what happened in Aurora, Colorado?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I mean, the incident or the attack in Aurora is quite difficult to discuss from a terrorism point of view, I think. Because there's still, as far as I have seen, there's no real indication that he had political motives. So it seems to be actually a case of mental instability. However, I think that there is a point to make in regards to double standards in that concern, and that is if this person that is mentally unstable, if he had been, for instance, of an Arab background, would it have played out entirely differently in the media? And I have to say that I'm not entirely convinced that it would not have played out differently. So I think there is certainly an element there. I think when we talk about terrorism, there is the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords is a much more interesting example there, because the perpetrator there as well has been talk about mental instability. And I think certainly there is a point to that. At the same time, it was a political act, and it seemed as well that he had the political background for doing it. And I think that it's a bit easy to sort of take it away from the entire political debate and pretend like it's not part of politics, that it has nothing to do with politics, and that it has nothing to do with rhetorics in politics. But it is a danger on the other side as well, and that's a danger that, of course, has been a part of the debate in Norway, because we have seen that Anders Behring Breivik in Norway, he committed his acts and he published this so-called manifesto or compendium, which was 1,500 pages and mostly derived from other sources, but highly political in content and obviously a right-wing extremist.
And Oyvind, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. And if you can stay with us for a few minutes, we have a caller who had a question for you. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, and we'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. Our email newsletter is a great way to keep up to date with local public radio, as well as find out the latest developments in non-commercial media. Every week or two, you'll get an email from us with updates on KALW programming and public events, as well as the occasional free ticket offer. And it's easy to sign up. Just click on the e-newsletter link on the homepage of kalw.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our new newsletter to find out what's coming up on Monday. How is the National Defense Authorization Act affecting our right to protest? It was signed last year by President Obama, includes controversial provisions. A judge struck down the law in May. So what is the latest and who is being affected? That's on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. Today we are talking about coverage of the one-year anniversary of the bomb and shootings in Norway with Øyvind Stråmann, freelance journalist who was given an award last year for investigating fascist and extremist groups in Norway. And his latest book is called Eurofascism. We're also joined by James Grimaldi. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He was recently at the Washington Post, where he spent a year on a team that worked on an investigative series called The Hidden Life of Guns. A number of incredible pieces, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. We'll talk to James about this in just a couple of minutes. And Roberto Lovato is a writer and commentator with New America Media. He's been closely following coverage of the two police shootings that took place in Anaheim last weekend. And before we get to that, let's take a call for Øyvind from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Mr. Stråmann. I was just wondering what your analysis, what you thought of how did Norway maintain its connection to its civil liberties, whereas in the United States there's a focus on there's a focus on not respecting them as much as taking care of security.
Thank you. Øyvind, how big is Norway? What is your population?
It's 5 million people.
5 million. Okay. That is so small. I'm always surprised by some small countries. I was just thinking about, you know, a country like the United States. How do you deal with these shootings compared to a country like Norway? But did Norway maintain its connection to civil liberties?
Well, until now, we have at least. I mean, there is obviously going to be a security debate in Norway, and that debate hasn't really started yet. And the reasons for this are quite complex. I think one of the reasons that Norway reacted in the way that we did, with having big rose parades and having a very civil process against Breivik, etc., one of the reasons for that is that it was a Norwegian that was the perpetrator. It wasn't a foreigner. It wasn't a Muslim or an immigrant. And I think that it would have been different if it was someone that could have been defined as an outsider. We saw some tendencies on the 22nd of July before it was known that it was actually a right-wing extremist and not, as many people thought, a radical Islamist that had had done the atrocities. So that is one reason. I think that a country would react, does react differently to that kind of event when it's coming from the inside rather than the outside, although I look at it as international terrorism. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I think plays a role is that all the questions concerning security and questions that are certainly going to be raised, and some of them are going to be raised with good reason, are questions that are also really difficult for a small country to tackle at the moment, because it's so close, the terrorist attack was so close to us all, and the people that are also responsible, the people who are in government, it was in fact their youth wing, the government party's youth wing, that was attacked at Utøya. And I think that has made many journalists, for instance, very, very afraid of drawing that debate too far, because it has been a feeling that if we took that debate too far, then it would be giving the blame to someone else than the actual terrorist. At the other hand, I think that there is also an important element that comes into play, and that is that we haven't really had a large amount of rhetorics in Norway that are promoting fear, that are promoting anxiety. which would have maybe been the case if it were a Muslim attack, if it was an Islamist, radical Islamist that was behind it. And as a result of that, people have been really looking towards other things and have found a shared feeling of belonging and of grieving together. And I think that several of our leading politicians from both the Labour Party, the main party, and from the Conservatives, the main opposition party, have been quite instrumental in managing to tackle the debate like that. And thus, it has become a process of big words. I mean, people have been talking about democracy and openness and about how we are going to show that, that this is not going to change us as a society. We're not going to become any less democratic or any less open as a society as a result of it. And it's very, very different. I think, however, there is a fair chance that that this is going a bit too far. Mm. I mean, Norwegians are currently sort of patting their own backs and saying, look, we did well. And I think that there's a risk to that as well.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about the response, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Øyvind Stråmand. He won the Freelance Journalist Award last year for investigating fascist and extremist groups in Norway. He is author of Eurofascism. And again, on July 22nd last year, 33-year-old Anders Behring Breivik admitted to bombing and a shooting that left 77 people dead. And you can find out more about Øyvind's work at yourcallradio.org. And it is our weekly media roundtable, and we're talking about coverage of the massacre in Norway. We're going to switch gears and talk about what happened in Aurora and also talk about the police shootings in Anaheim with Roberto Lovato, writer and commentator with New America Media, and James Grimaldi. In 2010, James was part of a team that worked on an in-depth investigative series called The Hidden Life of Guns. Check this piece out. There are many extensive stories about politics, protecting gun owners, the NRA's lobby. Another piece, over 62,000 guns unaccounted for in the U.S. since 2008. And James, when we thought about the show and we remembered your series, we just really wanted to bring you on to ask you, what insights did your investigation really give you in terms of the media narrative? And when something like Aurora happens, how are you making sense of just the formulaic media coverage that we've seen in the last week?
Well, it is pretty predictable, isn't it? You know, you'll get a statement from everyone, including the NRA, saying that their thoughts and prayers are with the victims. And then you get the story that says, you know, nothing's going to be done in Congress in terms of trying to fix the problem, and you have other people saying, well, there's no problem to fix. So there does seem to be kind of a monotony and a routine about that, because when something happens like this, people want to know, well, what can we do to prevent it from happening again?
Right. And so when, after all of the investigations that you've done into, you know, everything from the politics to NRA to gun dealers, how would you have covered Aurora? What questions do you think the media should be asking?
Well, let me just talk a little bit about the project, The Hidden Life of Guns. You know, back in the 90s, there and particularly toward the end of the Clinton administration, there were some academics as well as some policymakers in the government who had identified a particular statistic that was collected by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and that had to do with gun traces. Now, I need to explain a little bit about what that is. When a shooting like what happened in Aurora happens, the police get the guns, they look at the serial number, and to figure out who owned this gun or how it got into this guy's hands, they call the ATF's Gun Tracing Center, which is based in West Virginia. They contact, in West Virginia, the gun manufacturer to find out who it was sold to. And eventually they get it down to the gun store, and then the ATF or the police go to the gun store and get the form that has to be filled out by every person who purchases a gun. Now, what had happened with the academics in the 90s is that they were actually looking to see where most guns were being purchased. And they came up with a pretty stunning statistic, which was that most guns that end up being used in crimes were coming from a small percentage of gun stores. And what the Clinton administration did was to focus in enforcement on those gun stores, because the first line of defense, believe it or not, is your gun dealer in terms of whether they're selling to a criminal in what is known as a straw purchase. And that happens when, say, someone with a felony conviction who illegally cannot purchase a gun goes in with a girlfriend or a boyfriend and has them buy it for them, and it clearly is a straw purchase. Those are considered illegal. And by focusing in on those troubled gun stores, they were able to make some progress in sort of stemming the trade of guns to criminals. Well, around the 90s and the early 2000s, a congressman from Kansas who was very close to the NRA introduced an amendment that put harsh restrictions on the ATF and the government in terms of what they could use with this data. Through a variety of amendments over about 10 years, they've loosened that up a little bit, and for the first time, the ATF has filed sort of a national report about the gun traces. What we set out to do in our project was, well, let's see if we can find – we can break the secrecy and see where the gun stores are. And using similar state records, we were able to determine that most of the guns used in crimes in Washington, D.C. had come from one gun store about a mile outside the city limits in Maryland. And we focused in on that particular store. So I think there really could be a lot more transparency about what's happening with guns and the channels for which criminals get the guns and what happens in that chain and what problems there might be. We did have, one result as the result of our story on Mexico and guns to Mexico. They did put forth a rule that was opposed by the NRA, but it did go through, which would require multiple purchases of assault-style weapons on the border be reported to the ATF by the gun dealers so that they could actually try to stem the flow of these assault weapons that were going down to the Mexican drug cartels.
And the ATF says that the number of guns made in the U.S. rose 16% between 2010 and 2011 to 6.4 million. The FBI expects to run about 18 million firearm purchase background checks this year, up 9% from 2011.
Yeah, well, those background checks, it's interesting. Remember the three-day waiting period they used to have? That was to allow for the background checks.
Right.
Now the background checks are pretty much instantaneous. And the original opponent of the background checks, those checks, was the NRA. Now the biggest proponent of funding to make sure that those background checks are done in a timely basis is the NRA. They actually want those background checks done. And, you know, that's really a reversal over the past 20 years. Now, there are other problems with the check system in terms of who gets on the list. There was some suggestion that Jared Loeffner should not have been allowed to purchase those guns based on some of his background, in particular drug use that was uncovered when he applied for the military. And there have been some efforts to try to plug those particular holes. Right now, we don't know anything in the Aurora case that should have come to the attention of the authorities, but I think it's still early to tell. I think we may end up finding something about his personal background that would have prohibited him from buying these weapons.
We have a question from a listener who writes in, Angeline, what I haven't seen in a long while is someone going behind or deeper into our current gun culture. We acknowledge that the NRA is a powerful voice defending guns, including semi-automatics. And though extremely effective bullying, the NRA seems to have a lock on our Congress. Maybe 10 years ago, one did hear stories that described the gun industry as one of the largest and richest industries. Why haven't we heard about the place and role of corporations, this industry in particular, as part of our current discussion on guns? Has the NRA taken on the role of spokesman to deflect attention? What is the influence of the U.S. and global gun industry, and where is the coverage? What are your thoughts, Roberto?
Well, I think that the I was looking at coverage of Christian Bale's visiting the victims this week, and
Batman,
the man who played Batman,
right?
And the the guy in the suit that throws smoke bombs and blows things up and shoots people in the movie, and I was trying to think about the relationship. Is there a relationship between that movie and the gun industry? And there's no direct that we know of ownership. I mean, that might be an interesting other, but that aside, I think that I came up with a phrase that I wanted to share with people, which was we need to do something about ending what I call the franchise of redemptive violence. Redemptive violence being the main theme in perhaps most U.S. movies of an action kind and other kind, which is violence, somebody using violence to come in and save the day. There are not a whole lot of people that have somebody like the Dalai Lama flying in a cape and promoting peace, right? Instead, they fly in heavily armed to the teeth and blow people up, and we have a happy ending. And so that franchise of redemptive violence goes back, some would argue, to the founding of the nation itself. There's a deep, I think, and I have no problem publicly saying that, I think there's a deep, profound problem in the subconscious of the United States itself. It hasn't come to grips with its violent past. When you don't come to grips as an individual with a violent past, you continue patterns of violence. To the degree that the United States does not redeem itself peacefully with what it's done to Native people, what it's done to African Americans, what it's done to Latinos, what it's done to poor people, is the degree to which we will continue profiting heavily billions in movies that promote redemptive violence, in gun sales that promote redemptive violence, political profits that benefit from redemptive violence, and from news organizations. If it bleeds, it leads. So for me, that's the scale of the problem.
Well, let's talk about the gun industry, if we could, for a moment, to answer specifically the question. I want to give a plug for someone I've never met, but I've read his work, Paul Barrett. He works for Bloomberg now. He used to work for the Wall Street Journal and covered the gun industry. He has a new book out that answers the listener's question, called Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. It's the result of 15 years of research into the gun industry. And in fact, when we were working on our stories, I was reading his stories back from the 90s in order to sort of prep us for what we were doing. And it's really, from what I understand, it's getting good reviews, really quite a revelation. The closeness between the industry and the NRA is definitely present, I think. They say that they represent gun owners, but they're often in there, I think, representing the gun industry's interests. It's interesting, the NRA has been lobbying on something that really has not gotten a whole lot of traction in I don't think even among their members, but it has to do with small arms sales and a United Nations effort in order to sort of place some restrictions. I think there are negotiations in the State Department. And to me, that I think is probably something that has to do with gun sales more than it does with the particulars of, signing on to a particular UN treaty. So there is a closeness. There's also a separate trade group that lobbies on behalf of the gun industry. But if you look at our series, we talk a lot about the gun dealers. And I think from both sides of the coin, their point of view, as well as the others who may be the ones who are much more prone to selling to criminals. And I think if you look at our series at WashingtonPost.com/guns, you'll see some stories that address that and also address the politics in America. Basically, the politics work like this. In order for Democrats to control the House of Representatives, they have to have NRA-supported members. That basically stems from the fact that in order to control the House, they need to have members from rural districts. And in order to win in rural districts, you have to be either supported by or not opposed by the NRA. And we have graphics that sort of show how this works. And this is true in the Senate as well. It's a pretty simple calculus, and it explains the general lock that the NRA has on our politics.
Well, we have a few callers on this issue, so let's hear from Jamie in Santa Cruz. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. This is not a criticism specifically of the fine reporters on your show. As a matter of fact, I was responding partly to in advance to the redemptive violence discussion, but I'm really upset at news coverage. And when we just keep repeating, when it bleeds, it leads, I think this leaves off all of NPR, all of BBC, all kinds of people who are, in the last 3 weeks, all I've heard about are boring economic reports, blow-ups of people in Syria and in Iraq, and about Aurora. The chances that Columbine would happen 3 years after Columbine were the same chances as somebody who was 9-year-old having a heart attack. But if you when you interviewed mothers after that, 80% of them thought their children were going to be in a terror attack. The media is totally irresponsible in continuing to repeat this stuff day after day after day. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that the caller's right. That implied in the caller statement is that the industry, the franchise of redemptive violence, extends to foreign policy and into the newsroom. The newsroom is invested in covering violence in a certain way, not like James Grimaldi covers it. He covers it in a consequential and serious, investigative, and to the degree possible, objective form. But that's not the core of our newsrooms anymore. Budgets have been devastated.
Editors, well, that's your key right there, I think, is yeah. Budgets. Budgets have been devastated.
Budgets have been devastated, so you don't have... Somehow, the priority is not to pay people like James to go out and do what they do. The priority is to go out and do the stuff that's going to sizzle in the eyes of an audience that's conditioned to violence on the shows that come before.
Well, let's talk about the economics. It's cheaper to go out and cover police events than it is to do investigative reporting.
Right. Well, and James, you took the buyout from the Washington Post.
Yeah, I did.
And then went to the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
And are you? What is it like for you now at the Journal? Are you? Do you have the budget to go out and do a long series like the one you did at the Post?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of frankly amazed. Don't tell anyone, but you know, there really are enormous resources at the Wall Street Journal and a commitment to doing, I think, pretty significant journalism. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed at the depth of talent worldwide. It's really one of the last global newspapers left around, and I love the Washington Post. It was my home for 12 years, but you know, the resources at the Post just don't even begin to compare to the resources at the Wall Street Journal.
And just quickly, we had a quick question from Elizabeth. Please comment on Obama's relationship to the gun lobby and his stance on gun control. Yesterday, we did talk about President Obama receiving a failing grade from the Brady campaign for his the laws that he's passed or has not passed on gun control. And we'll put a link on our website. Do you have anything quickly to add, James? And I just want to get back to on Anna.
No, absolutely. I mean, you should go look at one of the stories we did near the end of the series where we talked about why they deep-sixed this rule that I just talked about before the 2010 elections, the midterm elections. The ATF had been trying to get the White House to approve, you know, something to stop guns, these automatic and semi-automatic assault-style rifles from going to Mexico with this rule, and Rahm Emanuel and others killed the proposal until after the election. And then they put it in, and, you know, there really hasn't been any hue and cry. I mean, the NRA opposed it, but I think it seems as if it's going to remain in place, and it's being used as a tool by the ATF to try to stem that the trade of guns to Mexico.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. It sounds like we should get Paul Barrett, author of Glock, on the show to dig deeper into these issues. Roberto, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted you to talk to us briefly about Anaheim and the coverage. Your main point is that Latino voices were missing. What happened after you contacted the AP reporter? And just again, because Democracy Now! Has been covering this extensively, it looks like most newspapers did carry AP stories. On Saturday, Manuel Diaz was shot twice from behind while fleeing from police unarmed. There was about 100 people that rallied. Police fired rubber bullets and pepper spray on children. Also, the next day, police shot and killed Jose Acevedo. His death is still being investigated.
Well, and there was another shooting, by the way, today. You should check out.
In Anaheim?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no, it's... But we don't talk about the police as if they're crazed or whatever when they use their guns. There's something... There's another standard that applies. So, quickly, compare these two quotes. Create the mayor saying that people are creating chaos in downtown and the police chief denouncing violence by the protesters. Compare that to, say, the mother of Manuel Diaz, who said, I watched as my son took his last breath. I watched as his heart stopped beating for the last time. You kind of have to search deep in U.S. media to find the voice of that mother. Mm. You don't have to search very far to find the police chief and the mayor. And that's typical in all the reporting all the time. And, you know, generally speaking. So we, again, like I was saying earlier, we have a different standard by which we talk about the perpetrators of extreme violence, whether they are white men or police, and a different standard when it comes to Muslim, Latinos, and a different standard when it's a white victim versus a non-white victim.
And what about this AP piece?
And the AP reporter, to her credit, because I don't want to besmirch a fellow journalist, Raquel Marie Dillon followed up with a great story about the demographic changes So activism makes a difference.
Yeah, and the LA Times, I have to say, has been doing really good coverage
and
on this.
The Orange County Register has people that actually live in the community, like Gustavo... Gustavo...
We'll find that piece. Thank you. Roberto Lovato is a writer and commentator with New America Media, and James Grimaldi is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Check out the investigative piece he did with The Washington Post called The Hidden Life of Guns. James and Roberto, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How is the NDAA affecting our right to protest? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the National Defense Authorization Act, which was signed last year by President Obama. The NDAA includes a controversial provision that could authorize the U.S. to indefinitely detain anyone without trial. A judge struck down the law in May, so what's the latest? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Who is being impacted? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, former Senator Bill Bradley weighs in on the state of our country with his new book, We Can All Do Better. Urban farmer Will Allen explains why he wants to start a good food revolution. And Bill Banfield is back with his latest essays of note on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up at noon here on KALW San Francisco 91.7, followed at 1 o'clock by Tavis Smiley and Cornell West, Smiley and West, at 1 p.m. Our next program from the BBC World Service in London is World Have Your Say. Stay tuned to your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco. The time is 11 o'clock.
BBC World Service, live from the Hare and Hounds pub in East London.
I'm full of anticipation. After all the bad times, I'm hoping that this next 3 weeks will change our attitude.
I'm Rita, the landlady, and in just 3 hours from now, just a discus throw from where I'm standing, the opening ceremony of London 2012 will begin. 7 years ago, we had T-shirts made back in the bid, and we won it, but I didn't know what to expect. Last week, my father was a torchbearer, and the minute I saw him walk the flame through the town hall gate, it hit home what the significance of the flame and the games really were. From me and Malcolm, the governor around here, we're ready to count down with you to the opening ceremony. So raise glasses, bottoms up from Team Hare and Hounds, let the fun begin.
You can't touch me, London.